So good evening. This is going to be an evening on right effort or energy and right action. And I'd like to start with an illustration that is actually quite common. And I work with a fair number of people one-on-one. And sometimes it's periodic. Somebody's trying to deal with something and they want an idea of like, well, how could I work with that dharmically? Or they want to work in some long-term basis on some issue in their life. But one of the most common things that people will come in, and it's something in this neighborhood, is they'll report that they're experiencing a certain state of mind they don't like, that they find troubling. So, anxiety, frustration, resentment, fear, anger, whatever it is. And then they'll say, I'm experiencing this. or I'll say, how do you work with that? And they'll explain what they do. It's like, when I get angry, I do metta, or when this happens, I do that, or I try to focus on my breath and what have you. And then invariably, we get to what happens when you do that, and the answer is, well, basically, the whatever the aversive mind state is doesn't go away. And the person feels like they're doing something wrong. There must be something wrong with their practice, they're using the wrong technique, and what's behind that, of course, is I'm failing. So, thinking that way would be a good illustration of wrong view. And what I mean by that is that we have to have a realistic understanding and realistic expectations about where this practice takes us and what is reasonable to expect. Okay. And I think that there are a lot of unstated assumptions for many, if not both of us, about Dharma practice, about what's supposed to happen or who we're supposed to become. And so this is a fertile area, because if we have a misunderstanding of what's reasonable, and we have a misunderstanding of what's reasonable to expect, it's kind of a guarantee for suffering, right? It's like we're gonna do all this effort, and we don't get a result that we think we should get, that isn't reasonable to expect that you would get to begin with. So, I want to talk about practice in general, understandings and expectations, and how those relate to effort and action. And then I want to talk about a subset of practice, which is the Brahma Viharas, metta, compassion, synesthetic joy, and equanimity. These very powerful, pervasive states of mind that we really need to cultivate and develop and learn how to use. So, to start with, from a global perspective, not because we've got all of these global practices, the Eightfold Path, and where those are designed to take us. And then we have these subset of practices, the Brahma Viharas is one illustration, that are designed to create a certain foundation that supports the larger purpose. Okay? So the overall purpose of energy and effort in relation to practice goals is to create a sufficient level of balance in the mind and the body to allow us to be present, to accept what is present, to examine it, and to see it clearly. Okay. So a sufficient level of balance, you know, not some kind of idealized and magical, you know, I'm just in such balance, you know, I've got Teflon on. Sufficient level of balance to be present. So that would be if I'm anxious, to be present with feeling anxious, okay? To accept it, which I think is one of the things that everybody always goes by. It's like, no, what I'm going to do is get rid of it. Okay, so accept it, then examine it, which we call investigation, and then see clearly, and see clearly sounds, you know, it's a simple term that's used, but what it is pointing to is seeing the nature of the state of mind that is present and how it operates in your particular body and mind. And the Buddha in the Satipatthani Sutra, which is the Sutta on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, over and over and over again, I don't know, I think it's 16 times, says that there are three things that in our practice and in our sitting and in daily life that we should be examining. This is where our attention should be going, what we should be looking at. And it's when a state of mind is present, how did it arise, what causes it to be sustained, you know, or to accelerate, and then what causes it to dissipate, those three things. Okay. And, you know, frequently we're doing those things after the fact, right? And we've gotten upset and we don't even realize we're upset, and we realize we're upset. Sometimes we catch it in the middle. We didn't see it coming up, but now we know we're in the middle of it and we want to make it dissipate. And sometimes, you know, our mindfulness in that particular instance, we can actually see it arising, which is the exciting part. But if we actually understood those three components, it would change everything. Because we would begin to actually understand in our unique body and mind how mind states are coming about and why. And that lays the foundation for working with them skillfully. So I think it's really instructive that the Buddha kept repeating this. And it's not just that it was an oral tradition, because there are refrains that are repeated that are obviously just transitional. And then there's things that are put in that aren't just transitional, that they're actually a reminder that in every instance of the description of the different aspects of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, 36 of them, that this principle of these three elements applies to everyone. Okay, so it pretty significant. So when you hear that, for me, it's pretty clear that the Buddha is being instructional that what we're trying to do first is understand states of mind, not do something about them. The first step is understanding them. Now, the urge that if you just think about any discomfort you have, or when someone says something, or your reactions in daily life, it almost seems like it's hardwired for us to immediately do or say something. You know, so you've got an itch and you're doing something and you don't even know you're doing it. It's so automatic, right? And then somebody's saying to you that it's creating some kind of agitation or arousal, and you know you're already, you know, you're just waiting for the opportunity to say something. And we frequently have this sense of wanting to escape. Like, if I can just get out of here, you know, that's what our mind is saying. So when the Buddha said that, this practice would always basically be a minority practice in culture if you understood what the practice was. He's very clear about that. And this is the reason. Because down at the most fundamental level, he's asking us to develop a new default urge. So the urge that we have is to do something. And he's asking us not to do something, not to do that. And instead, just be present and be with what's there and examine it. And if we could do that consistently, then what arises out of that is insight. And if we don't do that, then what we're doing most of the time is trying to fix something. Right? We're trying to get rid of something. We're trying to change things. And the first injunctive, from a general practice perspective, and we're going to get to specific practices where you're actually trying to create something, but the first injunctive is just be with what is present and accept it. Accept it, and not accept it in the sense that now I like it or that I'm acquiescing to it, but in this moment, right now, this is the truth of my life. You know, I'm filled with anger, or I'm filled with lust, or I'm filled with resentment or depression, right? And rather than like, I got to do something about it, I got to get out of here, it's like, no, just open to it and accept that that right now is the nature of your life. If you don't do that acceptance piece, it's almost impossible to examine it carefully, right? Because if I don't accept it, then I just want to get rid of it. Even if I stay there, I'm fighting. So this really is, I mean, this is, is a radically different internal approach to our internal life. And it's demanding. So that's kind of the starting place. And the importance of this is if we can do this, and of course restraint is a big part of it, you know, because initially what you're doing is restraining the urge to do something, or restraining the urge to escape, okay, or restraining the urge to change it. But that just takes a while, and once you start to do that, what happens is that your mind is able to settle in and actually be with something. And if you're willing to accept it, even though it's unpleasant, you suddenly start to have a sense of ease. It may not be pleasant, but I'm not struggling with having to get away from it. I was always struck, Joseph Goldstein was one of, in this tradition, was my first and most important teacher, and in many ways remains the most important single teacher in my life. And I listened to this talk that he gave. It was on a tape, and it really stuck in my mind. And at first, this is a long time ago, you know, when I was in the early practice, and he said, with mindfulness, it is possible to work with anything. Just this really simple statement. With mindfulness, it is possible to work with anything. And I just kept thinking about that, because at the time I was working with some really difficult stuff, and there was no way that it made any sense to me that he could make that kind of statement, you know, like a fairly categorical statement, you know, like more than anything, you know. And, you know, 25 years later, I believe that to be true. Now I think it takes a lot of intention and a lot of effort and years practice, and you know, a gradual process. It's a gradual path. But your ability to be able to be with things that previously were deeply troubling and would push you off the rails, you can actually stay on the rails and be with them, and actually have some part. Your mind can, this once again, this seems counterintuitive, and it goes against the Western model. But your mind can be agitated, and some part of your mind, kind of this core part of your mind that wisdom comes through, can have a sense of ease, even though your mind and your body are agitated. Because you know, you have a sense of what this is, how it works, you have tools to understand it, you know it's going to pass. So this kind of urgency to have to make it go away and do something about it changes. I mean, and patience and confidence start to replace the sense of urgency to do something. That's basically the model. Okay. So right action and right effort. Right action traditionally is actually referring to action. Okay. You know, there's not... It's not complex in the sense of a single idea trying to relate to two different things, which many of the concepts do. So it traditionally is associated with ethical conduct or morality. And so traditionally what's pointed to are the precepts, the training precepts for lay people, 5, and then there's 8 and there's 12, and then for monks and nuns, there's, I think, 300,000 or 400,000 or 500,000 or 600,000 And then right livelihood, that what you do with your, how you make a living, that there are certain things that you shouldn't do, that you should bring non-harming into your work, and these kinds of things, and right speech. So, and so then the precepts are non-harming, taking only what is freely given, speech, sexual misconduct, and consumption. You know, consumption of intoxicants. And the modern view on that includes food and other things, because we kind of become intoxicated with excited, you know, about all kinds of things. So I think you can view the fifth precept liberally now, you know, as food, sex, you know, all the things that we become addicted to and have trouble with, you know. So there's one way to think of right action and all, you know, ethical conduct as kind of a set of rules that you're supposed to follow. And it is very common in Asia when people to begin practice, where they'll be told, well, you just practice the 5 precepts for a couple of years and then come back. And that attitude of some teachers is that the baseline agitation of the mind is so great that just to start people with meditation doesn't make any sense, because the mind is so, you know, it's grasping, it's in aversion, and so they say, well, just do this, and then if you actually took your attention and put it on non-harming, or really serious about it, you know, you start to see all kinds of things, and then you start to see that to be non-harming to others and yourself actually involves restraint, you know, and then you start doing. So in each one of those, and then come back 2 or 3 years later and then we'll start meditating, you know. So that's kind of one idea. Another, and I think particularly the Western model of this form of right action, involves the effort and intention that you bring to it. So it's not, you're not just doing a physical act to do it. You know, like, I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that. Because you could be following all the precepts and just punishing yourself. You could follow all the precepts and just be riddled with rumination and desire. Because you're being successful at restraining yourself, but you haven't done anything to address the desire, you know, behind the restraint. So this is where right effort or energy comes in. It's like, what are we bringing to our actions? So you have the intention, and the vehicle for bringing that intention to action is the type of effort or energy that you bring to it. Okay? So one way to think of this is that right effort or right energy is what precedes and sustains right action. So to sustain some kind of continuity of mindfulness, continuity of kindness, of compassion, of restraint, you have to have a strong intention. The mind has to be balanced. There's a whole series of elements, all of which are energetic. Okay, so let me try to use a couple of illustrations to see if this helps at all. So all of us have some idea of what metta is. You know, it's this loving kindness. It's a special kind of kindness, which is the thing that makes it different. By definition, that it is unconditional. This is the thing that separates loving kindness from our normal idea of kindness. That it is unconditional, it is unbiased, it is like the sun, it shines equally on every person. So, metta extended properly. It would be extended to everyone here in this room, no matter how badly we may be feeling about ourselves tonight. And it would be extended equally to every member of ISIS. Good. So you start to frame it that way, and it's like, well, okay, you know. And you just hear immediately the conditionality of the mind, right? It's like, you know, a million reasons why I shouldn't think or send the wish to somebody, the guy who cut off somebody's head in the last video. I should send that guy a wish that he should be safe and protected, you know? And so it's huge. It's this huge idea, and so compassion is the same way. Sympathetic joy is the same way, and equanimity is the same way. And it's one of the reasons that it's so important to develop these, because they provide this huge container to hold both what is pleasant and what is difficult. And if we, with the metta idea, if we withhold from any human being the wish that at the deepest place in their being, we don't want them to be safe and protected and peaceful and happy and healthy and strong and not suffer, we will never have peace in the world. Never happen. And to the degree that we don't, there is something inside of us that is rigid, is separateness, and is identifying whoever the other person is as less than human or a different kind of human being than I am. And, you know, it's just a spectrum, depending on what happened to people, you know, and how they got there. It's like, you know, there's people on this side who, you know, intuitively, naturally, are just so kind, and over on this side, who knows why? You know, they're brutal. But there's a reason that happened to them. And if I was used to use the illustration of Saddam Hussein when he was in power, you know, actually, he looks pretty good now. You know, I'm not joking on some levels. You know, as brutal and as terrible, you know, as he was. You know, I mean, we really, this brutality that we're seeing now is like brutality on testosterone. I mean, it is really something. But I'd always say that, well, let's do metta for Saddam Hussein. You know, and people say, yeah, you're out of your mind, I'm not going to do. And what that means, and what I understand it to mean, is that if in fact, by some miracle, that man could have actually felt deeply cared for and safe and protected in his own heart, in the true sense of metta, it would have changed him. He would have begun changing and become a different person. And, you know, and this isn't some kind of fantasy. You know, I'm not putting out some idea that we're all going to do metta and the world's going to instantly change. But the idea of metta and the fundamental premise of Buddhist practice is that this is extraordinarily powerful in ways beyond our understanding. And any of you who have practiced metta seriously know this. You come to have experiences that you would not have otherwise anticipated in your life as a result of that practice. So with that long introduction, let's go back to the idea of these mind states are energetic, and cultivating them are energetic, and how would this apply to right effort and right action? Okay. So I'm sitting in meditation, and I'm doing metta, okay? Tell me what I'm supposed to be. This is not a rhetorical question, okay? Tell me what I'm supposed to be feeling. What are the characteristics? Everybody in this room has done metta at some level. What are the qualities that you would expect to experience if you're doing metta well?
Kind of light and easy, not tight, but nice, easy breath.
Okay. That would be true. What else?
A certain level of peace and well-being yourself.
That you would. That's right.
Openness.
And equanimity.
Well, we're going to talk about equanimity in a minute. So, which is and because it's a little different. It has different qualities. Okay. So.
A tremendous amount of love.
So, what does love mean?
Well, passion. Connectedness.
Okay.
With the world.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. Well.
Friendliness.
And one of the definitions of mindfulness is a kind of a fundamental unconditional friendliness towards other beings. Yeah.
I always feel a certain seriousness of intent. Intention feels very. In order to do it well, I feel I need to have a very serious intent inside. It's maybe comfortable in all those things, but it's quite focused. It feels quite focused.
And just to parse this out a little bit, it's quite focused, but does it feel like, in quotes, serious?
No, serious.
Yeah.
No, just,
right.
Just focus.
Yeah, so you're talking about the element of what you're doing with the attention. It is a strong focus to develop a particular experience, a feeling in your body, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I felt it's spaciousness.
Spaciousness, absolutely.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, this is for sure. Yeah. One more.
I think you have to have a sense of forgiveness and then translate that into forgiving others. It's to be able to send goodwill to ISIS.
forgiveness is absolutely related, and it may be a precondition, or it may result, it may come before or after. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, because frequently what happens is that people will do lots of practice on someone that they're really having difficulty with. And if you practice metta and use the phrases properly, and you know, you either call up an image or a heartfelt sense of this person, you know, you'll experience all kinds of things, you know, reservations, anger, frustrations, what have you, if they're a difficult person. You just keep doing the practice. People will have real breakthroughs, and then they'll do forgiveness practice because they have an opening of their heart, okay? And it's a safe opening. It's not like if Michael and I were that really had a big rift or some huge thing, for us to do something face-to-face until there's a bunch of preliminaries would be very difficult. But if I do this in the safety of my own mind, because you're completely in control of your experience with metta, right? You can stop at any moment you want. You can shift to Vipassana, whatever you want. But people will have these breakthroughs in relationship to the other person. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's a wise thing or a good thing to try to do some kind of reapproachment in real life. You know, the relationship may be so wounded or damaging. A number of occasions I can think of where people have come on residential retreat and they'll do metta for one of their parents or a relative who abused them in some way, emotionally, psychologically, sexually, been a problem all their life, have a huge breakthrough. Suddenly just feeling all this openness. And, you know, they'll say in group, when I leave here, I'm going to go talk with my father, my aunt, my uncle, my brother, whoever it is. And generally speaking, you know, our advice is, don't do that now, okay? Wait for a while, let this all settle. And you have to use a lot of good judgment. And some people will listen to you and some people won't. Most people who immediately leave with this enthusiasm don't have a good experience, you know, because they mistake their wide openness for the pot. But really, it's a deep hope that maybe there could be a reapproachment. Well, nothing's happened for the other person. You know, the other person's still locked in the drama, right? And I'm not. And then I go in and, you know, just, so it doesn't work. So, metta, when you do metta, and it's working, you know, it kind of like has a tempo momentum to it, it definitely has a feeling in the body and the mind. And it's light. You have this sense of lightness. There's this energetic sense to it. It's uplifting. I mean, you start to feel uplifted psychologically and emotionally. You get this sense of spaciousness. Frequently, people will describe it as a feeling of warmth. And some people mean that, experience it as a physical warmth. And some people mean that as kind of an emotion. They're really using it emotionally. You know, that there's this warmth or affection between myself and the other person. And what we're trying to do with metta practice as a baseline is we're actually trying to connect emotionally with the deepest meaning and intention behind those phrases. You know, may you be safe and protected. You know, the deepest wish we could have for another human being. If you can't feel safe and protected, it's hard to do anything really. You know, may you be peaceful. So you're trying to connect with that and then develop the ability to know how it feels to have that deep wish and intention for another person. Because it has a specific feeling, you know. So it's light, it's uplifting, it's spacious, a number of these different things. Energetically, it brings you up. Okay. So in hearing all those qualities, my guess is that most people in the room will recall times when they didn't feel that way doing metta. So the answer is why. Okay? Metta, as well as compassion practice, oddly, can bring up non-healthy states of mind on either side of the spectrum. So with metta, the idea is that it's this unconditional caring concern for another person. It is not based on self-interest. Although we say, you know, call up a person who is a benefactor or a mentor, you know, eventually you get to, we'll call up a neutral person. And then we'll call up somebody that's a problematic person. So although it feels personal when we first start doing it, it is a non-personal, wide-open caring for other people. Okay? So what will happen is, let's say someone's really sick, they're ill, so I call their image up and I start going, may you be safe and protected, and let's say they're sick. Okay? So it moves from kind of this, I'm completely in balance, I'm sitting here, I have this image or a heartfelt sense of the person, and I'm saying, may you be safe and protected, may you be peaceful and happy, may you be healthy and strong. And so, you know, a physical idea would be, here I am, I'm just completely planted, right? I'm in balance. And it turns into, and you know, there's a whole tone of voice that goes with this, but it's more like, may you be safe and protected, may you be healthy and strong, may you be me. You know, and I'm leaning, I'm no longer in balance, and now what I'm really into is desire, and I move into attachment. So it now becomes not cultivating this feeling in myself, but wanting that result for that person. Now I'm out of metta, I'm not doing metta anymore. Okay, does that work?
Yeah.
And so that has a very distinct feeling. That does not feel light and uplifting and spacious. It's just the reverse, because the qualities of attachment and craving, desire, are that it starts to collapse the mind, and it wants to hold on and make a result. So there's striving behind it as well. And so that feels constricted. You know, it doesn't feel light. It doesn't feel open. And it feels connected, but it feels connected in this almost claustrophobic way, okay? So that would be one end, okay? The other end, I always find this like, and this is another counterintuitive aspect of this practice, is you're sitting here, let's say, you know, when if you do this for very long, you end up, you know, calling up hundreds of people, right? You know, you look, you know, so you say, okay, well, I'm going to call up this really good friend of mine. You know, like, I know they're a good friend, and I really care for them. So, you know, you're doing it. May you be safe and protected. May you be peaceful and happy. And then what starts happening is that at some point you can catch yourself that you're saying the phrases with anger. You know, it's the oddest thing. So you're saying, may you be safe and protected, may you be peaceful and happy, and it's kind of like, may you be safe and protected, you jerk. But I don't know if you've had this experience, but if you practice metta for very long, you will have it. And it's the oddest thing, right? Because here your intention is, you know, open my heart, unconditional, you know, like, this is my good friend and what. And so what happens frequently when you do metta is it's a real bellwether if there's unprocessed stuff that you've got with another person. I mean, like, why is that going on? you know, so there's some seed there that's coming up. So you can hear from these two positions, that these three positions, that with metta, I stay in a place of balance, and I open unconditionally. If I'm not careful, if I'm not listening to my body, I start leaning over into craving and attachment. I want a result, or I start falling back the other way energetically. You know, like it's resistance, it's aversion. Okay, this is all energetic. You can feel all of this in your body when you're doing. May you be safe and protected, you jerk. You feel separated. You feel disconnected. You feel heavy. So if you did nothing else other than just watch the quality and the feeling of the energy in your body when you do metta, you would be able to figure out what to do. It's like, I'm not supposed to be feeling heavy and disconnected when I'm doing metta. Okay? So what do I need to do to open up? You know? Maybe you need to switch to Vipassana. Maybe you need to switch and use another person. Because the idea behind, and this is an important idea, it may seem obvious, but it frequently isn't. Let's say you call somebody up and you're just struggling like this. Okay? The idea isn't like, I'll just keep doing it, and then somehow it's just going to change on its own. That's not it. It's like, if you're there, if you know that you're either have fallen into craving or you're into aversion, and you see it, and it doesn't start to dissipate, then the instruction is get out of there. Okay? And so either switch over to regular Vipassana practice, or switch to somebody else that you know that you can reliably do metta for. Because what we're trying to do is cultivate and understand this deep feeling in our body. So you get no value at all. You get no points, no karma points for hanging in and repeating the phrases, because what you're doing is you're actually cultivating the opposite state of mind. It's not good practice, okay? So this is an illustration for me of like how the effort or energy is just so clearly right there for us. And if we just stayed in our bodies and felt it deeply, you would know when you were doing metta properly, when you had fallen into craving, and when you had fallen into aversion. You would know that. You wouldn't have to think about it, because you're just listening to your body. And then, you know, the next piece is, well, what do I do now? But the starting is this piece. And for many people, this is a different way of trying to practice metta. Okay? So I am just a firm believer that every aspect of this practice you can do energetically, in the sense of, and that's the reason, the first foundation of mindfulness is the body and the breath. That wasn't an accident. It wasn't just random. You know, it is reliable. You know, it won't lie to you once you learn how to listen to it. Okay? All right. So then I'm going to talk to about equanimity just briefly. So the characteristic of equanimity is that it is a sense of balance in the body and mind. And it is relating to whatever the experience is from a place of balance. So when we talk about the middle way, one of the easiest ways for me to think about equanimity is to think of it as a middle ground or a middle relationship to whatever is present. So you're not aversive to it, you are not craving something, you are in the middle. And this comes from a spacious perspective. And so when you have equanimity present, it feels very stable. Not stable in the sense of you know, like I'm planting my feet and, you know, you can't knock me off my feet. It's this stability that's dynamic, you know, that's very flexible. Like whatever comes up, my mind and my body stay in balance at some significant level, okay? So it feels very open, it feels spacious, you feel in balance, you have a sense of ease. You don't feel compelled to do anything, okay? So that's kind of fundamentally what it is. So when, once again, going with these two extremes of what you may fall into, there's a series of phrases that you use for equanimity practice, and you call people up just like you do in metta practice. And what can happen is that you will, rather than actually being neutral and in balance and in the middle path, which means that all the other qualities are still there. I mean, you're still caring, you know, metta's there. The mind slides over into indifference. So this is kind of the spiritual bypass part. You know, it's like you walk down the street and, you know, there's a just a pathetic homeless person that strikes, you know, just, you feel like just going to go knock me over. It's so powerful. And the response is self-protective, and it's like, well, that's just the way things are. It must be karma, you know. And this kind of indifference sets in, and the quality of indifference is separation, right? Like I am no longer connected as I am in metta and compassion with that person. So it feels disconnected, and it feels numb. You know, frequently when you're doing these and you'll drop in and you'll go to your body and it's like, I don't feel my body. So that's a pretty big sign, you know, something's going on. So that would be one end. The other end is that rather than being in balance and flexibly stable, you go out of balance and unstable and you fall into desire or aversion. So it's just the polar opposite, okay? Those are the two things. And so the phrases for me of equanimity practice are really significant because they are reminders of core qualities of mind and psychological stances that we're trying to develop. So here's just some of them. One is, and I mean, you've heard all of these, and some of them are pop culture, but, you know, we don't use them. Pop culture, we use them trying to connect with this very deep truth, okay? So things are just as they are. You know, it's like, I accept that. I'm not, you know, it's like, we lost somebody last night. I'm not going to escape from that. I'm not going to escape from the pain of it. That is one of the things, and that is the way that it is, and I'm willing to honor the truth of that and the truth of that in my life. I mean, that's what that phrase means, okay? So, like that, these phrases and that phrase in particular for me frequently, I'll use that frequently. You know, I'll find myself in the middle of a meeting, and I just want to take somebody's head off. You know, I'm so frustrated. And somehow this will just come to my mind. And it just allows me, it's just like some cool water flowing over my body. I just settle back and say, yeah, this is the way it is. You know, I don't have any control over this other person. And this is my life at this moment. And I am not going to turn away from my life. You know, that's always my mantra when I want to escape. It's like, no, this is my life. I'm not going to escape from my life. I'm not going to turn away from my life. Things are impermanent. Joy and sorrow rise and pass away. All beings are the heirs of their own intentions and actions. You your happiness and your sorrow depend on your intentions and actions, not upon my wishes for you. So this whole thing about boundaries, right? It's like, I can feel terrible about this, I can have compassion for you, but your joy or your sorrow is not dependent on my wish and is not my responsibility. And even if I want to make it my responsibility, it's not going to happen. Because it's dependent on your intentions and your actions. And it's very powerful. You know, like if you keep working with this and just embed that, you know, in your perspective. So one way to think of equanimity is it allows you to step back from this, the drama of what's going on, and hold it in a much bigger context. But you are still in connection with the suffering and the experience that's going on, you know. And there was a movie that was made a long time ago. Maybe this was in the 80s, and it was really radical in the 80s. And it was made by IBM, and I think it was called 8x8. And it shows a couple. It starts fairly close up with a couple eating on the grass at the Battery in the harbor in Chicago. And, you know, they've got a cloth and food and wine and everything. So then that's where it starts. Okay? And then it goes, and it goes back, I don't know how many feet. But now you're seeing that, at first you're just seeing them, you don't know where they are, right? And then it goes, and now you see that they are sitting in this grass and the harbor's around them. Okay? And then it goes again. You know, now it starts going up like this. And now you see that there's a harbor and there's a lake and there's downtown Chicago. And then 8x8 is it goes 8 times. And the last one, you know, you're out in outer space. You know, so pretty soon, you know, I don't know, maybe like 4 levels out, you can't detect that they're human beings anymore. But you can see movement and everything. And the next one out, you can't even detect the movement, but you can see the whole planet. And the next one out, you see that there's our planet and there's these other planets, you know. And of course now, this is in Men in Black, the first Men in Black movie. That's how the movie ends. You know, with this cat had this little
The galaxy.
Yeah, the galaxy. And that's how the movie ends, you know. So, but that's what it's like. It's like it like telescopes us back out so we can hold it emotionally in a bigger perspective, but we're still actually in the middle of what's happening in the connection. Okay. So, in terms of doing equanimity or metta as a sitting practice, we can feel all this in our body, and we can develop the practice, exactly the same practice that we're doing in sitting, in daily life. So, you know, you're sitting in a meeting, or you're having a discussion with a friend, or your child, or your boss, or whoever it is, and some part of you is awake to in your body and alert to what you're feeling. So that practice isn't a, you know, an intellectual thing. You know, it's like, geez, I have to be mindful and, well, do I feel metta? It's none of that. It's like, right now, what am I feeling in my body? And you practice for a little while, and if you're all tied up in knots, you know that you're not equanimous or in a place of metta. And you know that you better do something about it. You step back, take a break, take a breath, whatever it may be. So to the degree that I am a good professional, to the degree that that's true, I really attribute it to this practice. Because over many, many years, this is what I've worked on, is listening to my body. and frequently now. You know, I'm on a telephone call, I'm in a meeting, whatever it may be, and it's not really a thought. It's an experience arises, and intuitively, you know, it's this wisdom piece that just says to you, you need to do something. You know, this you get, and then when that happens, you know, then I open up my body. But so this energy piece, if we train ourselves this way, pulls us out of the kind of obsessive intellectualizing of this practice that many of us tend to do. And it's why we say that this is a body-based practice. Like, why do we say that? This is why, these illustrations. It's like actually practicing in our body and practicing to the extent that we don't have to think about it anymore. That we are looking for feelings and sensations in the body and then responding to those rather than just being driven by reactions to them. You know, that rather than feeling something averse and wanting to do something to make it go away, we actually want to stay there and open to it so we can understand it, because we know that that's the quickest way home out of suffering. You know, so. Okay, so that's it. So, thank you very much for coming. To the degree that you can, I would ask you to hold Roseanne and Vic in your thoughts and in your hearts. I don't feel compelled to like do something. You know, you don't need to make a call or anything unless you know them, and then that would be completely appropriate. But I know Vic, even if you don't know him well, the next time he's here, I'm confident that if you just quietly said something to him to show your support, it would be very, very meaningful to him, you know. So may Roseanne and Vic and all of us and all beings who are suffering anywhere on this planet be free from suffering. Thank you.